I want you to think about probably the oldest, most deeply ingrained rule in the entire history of business. Like, if you have ever worked a day in retail or food service, consulting, really any job where you interact with the public, you already know exactly what it is.
Oh, yeah. The customer is always right.
Exactly. The customer is always right. It is drilled into you from day one. You know, you keep them happy, you don't make waves, and above all else, you just finish the job.
Right. It's the golden rule.
But, I mean, what happens when that sacred rule collides with basic human physical safety? Like, what happens when a customer crosses a line, they put their hands on an employee, and suddenly that golden rule feels a lot more like a trap?
It creates this this profound, almost catastrophic collision, because you have the stated values of a company, which almost always involve, you know, protecting its people, crashing head on into the very mechanism that keeps the lights on.
The revenue.
Exactly. Customer revenue. And that impact, it sends these massive shockwaves from the isolated frontline worker all the way up to the executive suite.
And that collision. That's our mission for today. Welcome to the Deep Dive. Because today, we are unpacking exactly how an organization handles a high-stakes harassment scenario.
It's a really complex journey.
Yeah. We are going to trace this crisis from a frontline worker's split-second decision in the field all the way up to the intense pressure cooker of the executive boardroom.
And to do that, we are drawing on some really fascinating, highly specialized source material today. We're looking at two interconnected training scenarios.
All right, from Excellus.
Yes, developed by Excellus, which is a company that designs compliance training solutions.
And I just want to set expectations for you listening right now. These are not your typical, you know, cheesy workplace training videos with the bad acting and the super obvious answers.
Oh, far from it. No, the first scenario focuses on a frontline technician dealing with a real-time threat. And the second is this intense 90-minute simulation called the Executive Decision Lab.
Which sounds intense.
It is. It's designed to actively pressure test corporate leadership. It's a highly realistic look at the massive gap between what companies say they will do in a crisis and, you know, what their financial incentives actually push them to do.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because before a crisis ever reaches a fancy mahogany table in a corporate boardroom, a real human being has to actually endure it on the ground.
Right. It always starts in the field.
So we have to start with that frontline reality.
Mm-hmm.
Our source material introduces us to a field service technician. Her name is Renee, and she is out on a full day job, completely alone, at the facility of one of her company's absolute biggest accounts.
And the isolation is a really critical factor here. She has no immediate backup, you know? She is completely reliant on her own judgment in a physical space that is controlled by the client.
Yeah, and all morning, the client's manager has been crossing these, like, little invisible boundaries. He finds reasons to stand just a bit too close to her while she's working. He touches her arm.
Just those incremental escalations.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. He makes lingering comments about how she looks in her company uniform. And, I mean, what does Renee do? She brushes it off. She ignores it because he is a major client. And she just wants to pack up her tools, finish the work, and get out of there.
Which is such a natural human response.
Look, then it escalates. As she is packing up her van, this manager slaps her on the backside and laughs it off like it's a joke.
Mm-hmm.
And she freezes. Her phone is in her pocket. And she is faced with just an agonizing choice.
It's the moment right there where all the corporate training either works or it completely falls apart. And the scenario outlines three typical ways people respond to this exact situation. And the psychology behind each option is very telling.
So the first option is the one society seemingly rewards, right? Grit it out. Just swallow it, don't make waves, finish the job, and leave.
Which is catastrophic.
Yeah,
I mean,
right. Nobody
should have to endure a physical assault just to complete a work order. But beyond the immediate harm to Renee, gritting it out normalizes the behavior. It leaves her unsafe, the company's duty of care goes completely unmet, and crucially,
it sets up the next person.
Yes. It guarantees that the very next technician the company sends to that site is walking completely blind into the exact same danger.
Right. It just passes the buck to the next person on the schedule.
Right.
Which is awful. So if gritting it out is off the table, what about option two? Renee handles it herself, quietly. She tells the guy off. She sets a firm boundary, leaves the site. But she never actually reports it to her employer.
She figures, hey, I handled it.
Yeah, no need to involve HR, right?
Yeah.
I feel like a lot of people would choose that one.
And setting a boundary in the moment is completely understandable and often a necessary survival tactic. But keeping it quiet ultimately fails for the exact same reason as gritting it out.
Because they don't know.
Right. If the company never hears about the assault, they cannot protect her. They cannot protect the next worker. the account remains this hidden, ticking time bomb. Choosing silence ultimately protects the harassing customer, not the employee.
Which brings us to the third option, which is the only right call. She disengages immediately, gets herself to a safe location, stops the work, and reports it to her supervisor right then and there.
Hey.
Like, she doesn't owe that client a finished job.
Absolutely not.
But here's what I struggle with. The source material talks about this powerful pressure signal called deference, which is the fear that if she reports it, she becomes the quote-unquote difficult one.
Yes, deference is huge here.
I mean, think about that customer is always right mantra. It feels like a polite rule meant for, like, retail return policies that somehow got warped into a gag order on physical safety.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, we have to realize that this deference Renee feels, it is not a personal weakness. It is not a lack of courage. That deference is fundamentally built into the entire service model.
Okay, help me visualize that deference, because I think we all feel, you know, a mild version of it when we get bad service at a restaurant and we don't want to complain.
Sure, yeah.
Or the anxiety of giving a bad rating to a rideshare driver. But for a frontline worker like Renee, it has to be magnified 1,000 times over, right? Her paycheck, and maybe her whole crew's income, is tied to keeping this specific massive account happy.
That is exactly it. Customer harassment is so incredibly easy to absorb in silence because the financial pressure makes the worker feel responsible for the company's bottom line.
Wow.
But legally speaking, the company has an absolute duty to provide a workplace free of harassment. And that duty does not stop at the edge of their own payroll. It extends to third-party harassment.
Meaning the customers.
Right. If a customer, a client, or a vendor harasses an employee, the employer is legally obligated to act once they know or should have known about it. Finishing the job is never legally or morally required if it means enduring assault.
So they have to have her back.
Exactly. The real question is whether the company has proactively made it safe for Renee to speak up without fear of retaliation.
So imagine being in Renee's shoes for a second.
Mm-hmm.
You make the hard choice, you get to safety, and you report it. You do your part flawlessly. Now, this crisis travels up the elevator from the field to the corporate office.
Right into the boardroom.
Yeah. And this brings us to the second half of the Excellus scenario, the executive decision lab, which is called the account.
It is a fascinating exercise in corporate psychology. We're moving from physical survival on the front line to corporate survival in the boardroom.
Right. In this simulation, our fictional company is called Widmer Global. They place field techs on site.
Mm.
And the harasser. He's a senior manager at Clements Global Telecommunications, which just happens to be Widmer's single largest, most lucrative account.
The absolute crown jewel of their portfolio.
Yeah.
The stakes could not be higher for anyone in that room.
And there is a strict rule of the room for this 90-minute leadership pressure test. The facilitator sets a hard boundary. The executives are never allowed to debate whether they should protect the worker.
That's a really smart rule.
Because if you frame it as a morality play, asking, you know, should we do the right thing? Corporate executives love nothing more than nodding solemnly, pretending to be ethical philosophers, and agreeing that safety is paramount.
And then the test is ruined because nobody is actually tested. It's remarkably easy to be moral in theory when you aren't staring at the financial consequences.
So what does this all mean? To me, it feels like claiming you are on a very strict diet and you genuinely believe you are, but then someone places a $1 million chocolate cake right on your desk and tells you it's your job to eat it.
That's a great way to put it.
But I have to push back a little here on the boardroom dynamic. Do corporate leaders really sit in a room and consciously choose money over their employees' physical safety? Are they literally calculating, well, Clements pays us $10 million a year, so Renee is just going to have to take one for the team?
What's fascinating here is that nobody in that boardroom will ever explicitly say, let's trade her safety for revenue. You will never hear those words spoken out loud.
Because that would sound evil.
Right. If they did, it would be easy to identify the villains and fire them. Instead, the company's own internal incentives quietly make that trade for them.
Are you saying that because their bonuses and their stock options and their quarterly targets are tied to that revenue, their brains subconsciously look for excuses to delay pulling the plug on the client?
Exactly. They fall into the trap of delay. They use reasonable sounding corporate speak to avoid the pain of action.
Yeah, like what?
They say things like, let's not overreact until we have all the facts, or, hey, let's just quietly rotate Renee off the Clements account so there's no drama while we look into this.
Oh, wow.
They don't call it sacrificing her safety. They call it managing the relationship. But the outcome is exactly the same. The revenue dictates the response.
To really understand how that trap of delay actually closes on good people with good intentions, the training uses three escalating phases, which they call injects.
Yeah, the injects are where it gets real.
But instead of just listing them, picture this unfolding over a single, highly stressful afternoon at corporate headquarters. So inject one. The first thing that happens is the facts land on the boardroom table. Renee reported the harassment.
Okay.
But immediately, the room realizes who the harasser is. Instantly, the massive revenue at stake becomes the giant, unignorable elephant in the room.
And in this initial phase, the executives are just sizing up the situation, but the financial weight is already distorting their judgment. You know, they are looking for a way out that doesn't involve confronting their biggest client.
And just as they're debating what to do, inject two hits, the pressure ramps up, Clements, the client, starts leaning on the relationship. Maybe they call up the VP of sales and complain that Renee is, you know, making a big deal out of nothing and being unprofessional.
Right, trying to spin the narrative.
Meanwhile, the end of the quarter is looming, the numbers need to be hit, and the room naturally starts drifting toward that comfortable middle path, the path of least resistance. Let's launch a slow, quiet, internal investigation. Let's just shuffle the staffing.
They feel like they are being prudent managers. They think they are de-escalating the situation.
But then, inject three, the detonator goes off. The boardroom finds out that Renee, the technician, has retained outside legal counsel, and a public court filing is imminent.
Oh, boy.
But here is the kicker. The lawsuit names both companies. It names Clements Global for the actual conduct of their manager, and it names Widmer Global for failing to protect a worker from known third-party harassment.
It is a brilliant twist in the simulation because it forces the executives to confront the reality of their delay.
Here's where it gets really interesting. I look at this and I see these executives holding on to this winning lottery ticket, their biggest account, only to suddenly realize the ticket is literally on fire and burning their hands.
Yeah, it's a huge liability now.
But I have to ask, isn't saying let's investigate first just standard by the book business practice?
Right.
Why is taking a beat to gather the facts considered a fatal trap? Wait, does it have to do with that legal duty you mentioned earlier?
This raises an important question about how the law actually views corporate responsibility in these moments. The key legal concept here is the reasonable steps doctrine.
Okay, reasonable steps.
Right. A company is protected from liability only if it can prove that it acted promptly and appropriately once it knew about the harassment.
So if the clock starts ticking the second Renee reports it, how does a 10-minute conversation about quarterly revenue prove they failed to take reasonable steps?
Because in the eyes of the law, every minute spent agonizing over the quarterly revenue and every minute spent talking about not overreacting is a minute explicitly not spent protecting the victim.
Oh, wow.
That hesitation, that delay now becomes Exhibit A in Renee's lawsuit. It proves the company prioritized the client relationship over stopping the abuse.
No slips on them.
In an instant, everything inverts. The incredibly valuable account they were bending over backward to protect has suddenly become their co-defendant and a massive reputational liability.
The thing they were trying to save is the thing that is destroying them.
Precisely. Their own financial incentives engineered their downfall. By trying to protect the revenue, they guaranteed the lawsuit.
That is terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
It forces us to look at who is actually sitting around that mahogany table. Because corporations don't make decisions. People do.
Exact.
Who actually has the authority to pull the plug on the company's biggest client? The lab breaks down the boardroom into six distinct seats, and the friction between them is intense.
Each seat carries incredibly conflicting pressures. You have six highly competent people who are practically incentivized to fight each other.
Right. Think about the chief revenue or sales leader.
Mm-hmm.
They own the Clements relationship. They feel the potential revenue loss directly. And the source material makes a great point here.
Mm-hmm.
They aren't the villain.
No, not at all.
They are literally just doing the job they were hired to do, which is protect the revenue. Their scorecard is entirely based on maintaining that relationship.
Then consider the chief operations officer. They own the field workforce. If Renee is pulled off the site to protect her, the COO is the one who has to figure out the logistical nightmare of who else to send.
Right, the scheduling.
And worse, they have to wrestle with the moral dilemma of sending another worker into an environment they now know is dangerous just to fulfill a contract.
Next to them is the head of HR, or the CHRO. They own the duty of care. But they are also managing the internal optics. They know that every single employee in the field is watching the situation like a hawk.
Oh, word travels fast.
Exactly. The workforce is waiting to see whose side the company is actually on. If leadership falters, the CHRO knows they will lose the trust of the entire company overnight.
And while HR is worrying about culture, the general counsel, the chief lawyer, is staring at the employer liability. They are watching the clock tick, knowing that every second of delay increases their legal exposure for known third-party harassment.
Because of that reasonable steps doctrine.
Yes. They know that a slow investigation is indefensible in court.
Then you have the CFO. Think about the CFO at your own company. If they were staring at a massive $10 million loss, do you think they'd pull the plug in 5 minutes?
Probably not.
Initially, they are just weighing the loss of Clement's revenue. But by the time that lawsuit hits, the math changes completely. Now they're weighing the lost revenue against massive incoming brand damage, skyrocketing litigation costs, and a tanking stock price.
And ultimately, all of this chaotic, conflicting advice lands on the CEO. The CEO has to make the final call, and more importantly, they have to signal to the entire company whose safety is negotiable and whose is not.
It sounds like a high-stakes game of corporate hot potato. You have six people in a room, and every single one of them is being graded on an entirely different scorecard.
Yeah.
Sales cares about the invoice. The general counsel cares about the lawsuit. HR cares about the culture.
Right.
So I have to deduce here. Does any company actually have a hard dollar amount attached to an employee's safety, or are they just making it up as they go along in a total panic?
That right there is exactly what this decision lab is designed to surface. The terrifying truth is that most companies have never established who actually has the authority to fire a customer before a crisis hits.
Wow. They wait for the fire to start before they try to figure out who was allowed to buy the fire extinguisher?
They decide it incident by incident under immense pressure while staring at competing spreadsheets. And that is a recipe for absolute disaster.
Because the money talks.
Exactly. If you wait until a massive account is on the line to figure out who is allowed to say no to that money, the money will win every time. The lab forces executive teams to realize that a worker's safety cannot be weighed against an invoice in real time. They have to decide, in advance, a named owner with the authority to fire an abusive client, regardless of the revenue impact.
This has been an incredibly eye-opening dive into the hidden mechanics of corporate crisis. It's time to synthesize what we've learned today.
It's a lot to take in.
It is. But whether you are a frontline technician like Renee, driving a van and working alone, or a CEO sitting in a corner office trying to balance the books, the underlying truth remains exactly the same. Protecting the worker must come before preserving the account.
The customer is always right is a philosophy for handling a botched food order, you know, a late delivery or a disputed invoice. It never, ever gives them the right to harass or assault. And no employee owes an abusive client a finished job.
But the system is designed to make you quiet. Deference is baked into the revenue model, making you feel like you owe the company your silence. But as we've seen, staying quiet only protects the abuser and leaves the next worker in the crosshairs.
And for leadership, it's just as stark.
Right. For the leadership sitting around that mahogany table, hesitating to protect that revenue is exactly what turns a bad situation into a catastrophic lawsuit. The hesitation itself is the trap.
If leadership waits to gather all the facts while prioritizing the relationship, they have already failed the test.
So I want to leave you with a final lingering thought to mull over today. Think about your own workplace. Think about the dynamics in your office.
Yeah, picture the big accounts.
If your organization's absolute biggest, most untouchable client crossed a major physical line tomorrow, do you actually know who has the authority to fire them? Or would everyone just stare at each other across a conference table while the clock ticks, desperately trying to protect the revenue while the liability burns the house down? Something to think about. Until next time, thanks for joining us on this deep dive.